middle name. My father apparently didn't like his. He didn't give my brother or me a middle name. And when I registered for the draft, I got a call from the draft board like relatively soon. And that's kind of scary. It's like, what do they want? And they said, you didn't fill out your middle name. I don't have one. Okay. My number came up really, whatever you call it, high or low, 340 something, like I wasn't going to be drafted, so. Okay. I think I probably gave a hint on atonement where I was going to go with the next sermon. So there are previous two sermons that I gave in the congregation here. I were in the book of Hebrews. The first sermon, I covered Hebrews chapter 1 all the way to about chapter 8 to give a background and a context for Hebrews 9 and 10, or parts of chapter 10, that I was going to cover on atonement. So I wanted to give the background before that so that I could just focus on those verses that I wanted to on atonement. And that was very helpful for me because I learned the context, I hope you did too, of what the writer of Hebrews was trying to accomplish. And we learned a lot, I think. You know, we didn't know, we still don't know who wrote the book and really exactly who it was written to. Although this congregation appears to be a group of people to whom the Old Testament scriptures, what we call Old Testament, that their scriptures were very important to them. The writer quotes the Old Testament 30 to 40 times, as well as some other allusions that are not direct quotes. So it was it's obvious reading it today that the writer knew that would be that those writings were important to this congregation, and that's why he included them. We saw that there's a major emphasis on Jesus having fulfilled the original aim for Adam, which was to be the representative for God, and created in God's image to represent him on earth. Adam failed, and Jesus succeeded. And because of that, Jesus, the reasoning goes that Jesus was superior to Moses and even to the angels, for that matter. We also saw that, therefore, this congregation respected and even feared, in the right sense, the contents of the Old Covenant, the Old Testament. They respected those writings. They realized the penalty that existed, or the penalties that existed, for not following the covenant, the rules in the covenant. And the writer makes the point that now that he's established that Jesus is greater than Moses, that the witness of Jesus himself should be respected and feared even more than the respect they already had for the Old Testament scriptures. He warned them not to be guilty of the same sins that their ancestors were, that of unbelief, the sin, as he puts it, that kept a whole generation out of the land of promise. You know, that's a lesson for us. Don't be guilty of the same thing. He goes to great length, talking about Melchizedek and other things, to show that Jesus is our high priest in modern times, and he's also a son. Hebrews reflects what's called a high Christology, that Jesus is the Son of God and also our high priest. And in connection with the high priest, he talks a lot about sacrifices. That's what led us into the Day of Atonement. And he points out, by use of certain analogies with things in the Old Testament and the way the priests operated in under the Old Covenant in the temple, he shows that what Jesus accomplished dealt with sin in a way that was complete and final, didn't have to happen again. You know, it says that Jesus went and sat down by the right hand of the Father, whereas in the Old Testament, the priests could never sit down because, I mean, obviously, they did sit down and rest and sleep and so forth. But his point is, they had to offer another sacrifice. After the morning sacrifice was the evening sacrifice. After the evening sacrifice was the next morning sacrifice. It was a continuing cycle of sacrifices. Once Jesus did it, it was done. It was done. It was final. And that's important. And again, that's why all this was the background for some of the things we learn on the Day of Atonement. Jesus fulfilled the symbolic action of blood with respect to sin. It was his blood that was the it was connected to sin, and just as sin, as blood was connected to sin in the Old Testament. But in doing so, by Jesus doing it with his blood, he opened the way into the Holy of Holies. And the writer makes a big point about that, that we, in the Christian era, have access to the throne of God, where that wasn't the case before. And therefore, things are very different now. The Old Testament, the Old Covenant, was just a type of the way things were. It was to lead us into this. So things are very, very different. So the question, the obvious question is, all right, it's different, so what? What about it? And he answers that question. You know, with this understanding, how is my life going to be different? What should I do now that I understand this? What should I be doing? What should I be thinking? So let's dig into just a few more verses, because I stopped in Hebrews 10 at verse 18, but there's the rest of the chapter there. And, you know, chapter divisions were put in later, but there's good reason for ending Hebrews chapter 10 where it's ended, and spend, because it begins a new thought in chapter 11. So we'll cover the rest of Hebrews chapter 10, where the writer answers the question, if you had it, I would have it, now that you have all this understanding about what Jesus accomplished and how the Old Testament prefigured this and how important this is, now what? So what? You understand this, now what? Well, he handles that. Jesus' actions demand a response from us, and that's what he talks about. So I was going to bring the New American Standard because that's what I normally use, but I didn't. So you can read along with whatever version you read in. I'm going to be reading from the King James because that's the one I have, but I will be referring to different ways that certain words could be translated. Starting in chapter 10 and verse 19. And you can tell that this is a thought. And I probably pointed out before, you have certain expositions that the writer does, and then there's certain warnings. Now that you understand this, here's a warning, and so on. And that this is one of the warnings. Verse 19 says, having therefore, in other words, now that you understand this, having therefore, brethren, boldness to enter into the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way, which he has consecrated for us through the veil, that is to say, his flesh, and having an high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful that promised. And let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. For if we sin willfully after that we have received the knowledge of the truth, there remains no more sacrifice for sins, but a certain fearful looking for of judgment and fiery indignation, which shall devour the adversaries. He that despised Moses' law died without mercy, under two or three witnesses. How much sorer punishment, suppose you, shall he be thought worthy who has trodden underfoot the Son of God and has counted the blood of the covenant wherewith he was sanctified as an unholy thing, and has done despite unto the Spirit of grace. For we know him that has said, vengeance belongs unto me, and I will recompense, says the Lord. And again, the Lord will judge his people. It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. But call to remembrance the former days in which, after you were illuminated, you endured a great fight of afflictions, partly while you were made a gazing stock, both by reproaches and afflictions, and partly while you became companions of them that were so used. For you had compassion of me in my bonds, and took joyfully the spoiling of your goods, knowing in yourselves that you have in heaven a better and enduring substance. Cast not away, therefore, your confidence, in which which has great recompense of reward. For you have need of patience, that after you have done the will of God, you might receive the promise. For yet a little while, and he that will come, and will not tarry. But the just shall live by faith. If any man draw back, my soul will have no pleasure in him. But we are not of them who draw back into perdition, but of them who believe to the saving of the soul. And from there, he moves into a different thought. He starts talking about faith. And we're going to stop there and just cover those verses. Now, it's a lot of verses. It just seemed to go on and on, but there's a pattern there. In fact, it's a similar pattern. It's a pattern of exhortation. We saw that already when we were looking through. We saw it in Hebrews 5, chapter 6. You know, 5:11 says, "Of whom we have many things to say and hard to be uttered, seeing you're with all of hearing. For when a time you ought to be teachers, you have one to teach you again what be the first principles." And he starts giving them a little bit of admonition. That's what we have going on here in chapter 10 as well. What we have is a reminder. I'll give you the summary ahead of time. We have a reminder of the congregation's special relationship to God, and therefore the responsibility. There's a warning with respect to apostasy. And there's encouragement for past actions, and appeal to certain future behavior. It's a separate unit, these verses that we just read, it's a separate unit of this sermon. I mentioned before that Hebrews seems to be organized like a sermon that would be sent as a letter to a congregation and then read in the congregation. And you might have noticed, or you might not have, but we have a word. Now, maybe you don't notice it. Depends on how the translation is. But in chapter 10 and verse 19, "Having therefore, brethren, boldness." Who has a different word in their translation there in verse 19? Boldness is one. Any others? Everybody has boldness? Not everybody's there. Yeah, go ahead. Confidence, okay. What are you reading? What version do you have?
English Standard.
Okay, English Standard. Confidence, boldness. Anybody got something else? Okay, this is too good. We'll talk about that word a little later. That's verse 19. Then, if you notice up in verse 35. In King James, it says, "Cast not away, therefore, your confidence." So those that have confidence have it again, confidence. So they're bookends there. Again, when these people wrote in an oral culture, they used little hints in how they wrote so that when you read it, and if you were one of the ones sitting there hearing it being read, you could tell what sections were what and how it's broken up. You know, when they wrote in Greek, it was all capitals, no punctuation. You know, so how did you specify what, you know, how things are broken up? One of the ways you did it was through certain little tricks like that, and use a certain thought that starts what you're talking about and ends what you're talking about, and that's what you have here. Not that the thought ends right at 35, it ends a few verses later, but they're kind of like bookends to this. We have this confidence, don't throw that confidence away. That word for confidence, again, we'll talk about it in a minute. It's, I won't say any more now. So there's 17 verses here. And you could break them up into four sections. That's how I'm going to look at it. Verses 19 to 25 would be the first section, which basically saying, because of this, therefore, let's do this, this, and this. That would be the first section. And then in verses 26 to 31, you have another section or paragraph. Some commentaries have called it a paragraph. There's a strong warning. What if you don't do what you should be doing? The warning there. And then the third paragraph from verses 32 to 35 would be an encouraging section with some praise for what has already been done in the congregation, the works they've already had, and an encouragement to keep it up. And finally, the last paragraph, verses 36 to 39, kind of a conclusion and introducing a few terms that lead into the next thought, which is the roster of faithful people and their works in chapter 11. So let's dig in, beginning back at verse 19. You know, now that, you know, we had these, you know, I did two sermons and covered what the writer is doing and how he's establishing Jesus as the high priest, as the leader of the church and so forth, and making sure that we understand his status is above that of Moses, above that of the angels. And he's the Son of God. It's different. And now that you understand that, what difference does it make? And that's what he's going to answer. Verse 19 through through 21 will be the first thoughts. You know, and he says, as we already read, having therefore, brethren, boldness or confidence to enter into the holiest by the blood of Jesus. Now, you probably have an English standard to say, does it say Holy of Holies or does it say holiest? Anybody have Holy of Holies in their version? That's what it's talking about, entering into the Holy of Holies, which you only did if you were the high priest, and you only did on one time a year on the Day of Atonement. So now he's saying we have the confidence to enter in there with Jesus' blood anytime. And the word is confidence, or the word is boldness. That's an interesting word. It's parisia, okay, or parisia. And it means boldness. That's okay. It means confidence. One commentary I was looking at, the word biblical commentary, the translation they used, they said authorization. I thought, well, it doesn't mean authorization. That's not what it looks like. But when you understand the context here and what it's talking about, it kind of means that. That word, parisia, that word in Greek use referred to the right, in a way, maybe that's the wrong word, but the right that a citizen had to speak openly, speak publicly in the, it was a democracy, right? So, certain people, not everybody, but there was a democracy for those days. And, if you were a slave or something, it didn't count. But, the landowners, whoever it was that was part of the democracy, they had the right to speak at the assembly. And to say what they wanted to say, and they had to be, and they had the right to be heard by everyone else. Everybody else had to be quiet and listen to what you said. That's the way the word was used. It had to do with speaking in public with a confidence that somebody cared what you were saying and that you had the right to say it. And in other places in the Bible, it's translated. I think I wrote down. Or did I? Maybe I didn't. Speaking plainly, speaking openly, publicly, with boldness. So all of that is combined. It's part of what the context of that word back in those days. So the writer here is saying, you have, because of what's happened, because of what Jesus did, not anything you did, but because of what Jesus did, you have the right. Not just the opportunity, but the right to approach the throne, speak openly, publicly, as it were. I mean, you're not really public, but you understand what I mean. You have a standing now where you can go to God and have a conversation. Now, we take that for granted, maybe, because of that's what we were brought up. Most of us in a Christian environment, and we assume that we can pray and God hears. But do you understand how radical that is? That you and I have the not just the opportunity, but we're guaranteed the right, because of what Jesus did, to go to the ruler of the universe and have an audience without invitation. That's an amazing thing. It was an amazing thing back then. It's still an amazing thing. To think that that's the way it works. So that word, it says confidence or boldness. You understand the context of it now. It's confidence because you know that you have the right to be there and that you're going to be listened to. And of course, we understand that has nothing to do with anything we've done. But that's an amazing thing if you just take a couple seconds and think about it. That's very different from what the Jews understood, where the high priest only went there and only once a year and only with a bunch of sacrifices and purifications and waters and sprinklings and blah, on and on and on, that we could do it anytime. It's because of the blood of Christ, as is pointed out there in verse 19, because of his blood. So we have that tie-in to the way it was in the Old Testament. So we're authorized. That's not a bad translation necessarily. You can go there with confidence because you know you're allowed to be there. You don't have to kind of shuffle your feet. Excuse me, maybe you got time for me. No, it's not like that. And that's just an amazing thing. And it says more so, it says, by a new and living way, now I'm reading King James again, which he has consecrated for us through the veil, that is to say, his flesh. A new and living way. Now, those are interesting terms. Why is it a new way? Well, it was new because, you know, I don't know how, when we don't know exactly when Hebrews was written. We assume that the temple wasn't destroyed yet, so probably in the 60s, but maybe 30 years after Jesus died or so. So this had only been the case for a generation. It was new. It was new in history. And it was a living way. It had to do with life. And I never thought about that before until I was working on the sermon. But in the Old Covenant, all the things that had to do with dealing with sin had to do with death, didn't they? You had to have blood. And they didn't take it from live victims. They killed the victims, and then you had some blood. Unless it was a flower offering. But all the other ones involved blood. So this was a new and living way. Jesus did die, but then he's resurrected, he's alive, and we don't have to keep killing him. So it's not only new, but it's very different in that it's a living way and not a dead way, not a way that results in death or that requires ongoing death. You know, it was just one death, one time. So it's a new and living way. It's different. It was a recent development. It focuses on a renewed life. As we learn during the Day of Atonement, you know, those ceremonies, of course, focused on death. But the Day of Atonement dealt with sin in the Old Covenant in a way that had to be repeated the next year. When Jesus did it, it didn't have to be repeated. And that's different. That's a new thing. We don't have to continue to do the sacrifices, which the writer points out, and I think Paul does too, that those sacrifices didn't really accomplish anything. I mean, they did. They showed that there's a cost to sin. It costs money to buy those animals or to raise them. But it didn't fix the sin problem because you had to keep doing it. Whereas Jesus' sacrifice did fix the sin problem. So that's new and different. It did change something. And verse 21 says, "And having a high priest over the house of God." I think the New American Standard says a great high priest. Do any other translations have more than just a priest, high priest there? Any adjectives? You got something there? I thought John.
A great priest?
A great priest, okay. There must be something there in the Greek. I didn't look it up, but that indicates it's not just a high priest, it's a great high priest. And it says that he's over the house of God. So this congregation that the writer of Hebrews is writing to, this congregation here, any other congregation, we have a high priest that's over us, and that's Jesus, the resurrected Jesus. And he's caring for the church. And so these things are different, all right? We have something that's different because we have a high priest, and because now we have this confidence to approach the throne, there should be a resulting behavior from that. And that's what he goes into in the next verses. Because this is the way it is, now we should be doing something. And what does he say we should be doing? Well, verse 22 says, "Let's draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water." So the first thing he lists is that we need to draw near. And the implication is, you know, drawing near to God. That word, drawing, it's translated drawing near, is moving toward or approaching. So because we have this confidence, because we know that Jesus has opened the way, we are to draw near or to approach. Now, what does that mean? We think, oh, we've got to be close to God. Well, yes, it means that. But specifically in this context, the way it's being written, it means walk up to the throne. Have that conversation. You have access. Now you got to go. It's not enough just to say, oh, I have access. Things are wonderful. I'm going to sit here on, sit here in my easy chair. No, get up, go to the throne. You have access to it, but we have to move. We have to go there. Now, figuratively, obviously, I'm saying. So drawing near, maybe in our modern terminology, it doesn't have that same connotation, but those words mean approach. Go there. Move toward. You have access to the throne, so go. Get up and go. That's the first thing that we're told. It says our hearts are sprinkled. The Old Testament priests had to have, there were various sprinklings, and sometimes people were sprinkled with blood, sometimes they're sprinkled with water. It's water of purification. There's all these things going on. It's a symbolism for being purified. And here it's used in a spiritual sense where our insides are purified, not our outsides, not our hands or our heads or something, but it's inside. Now, why? Why? What did those sprinklings accomplish? Anybody, what did those things accomplish in the Old Covenant? What did they do? Or what did they indicate? Anybody? It was a form, I think it's correct to say it's a form of sanctification, of setting apart, making holy. Moses, in effect, he couldn't sprinkle all the people, but in effect he did. He sprinkles this out onto the people. They're set apart. They're God's people. They've been covered by this blood. So that's what the implication is here. That we've been sprinkled. In other words, we've been set apart. We've been consecrated. We've been made holy through this process. And having our bodies washed with pure water, of course, an allusion to baptism. But through that, we've been made holy. What's that mean? All of a sudden we're perfect? No. It means we're set apart. We belong to God. We're set apart for that holy use. We're to be living sacrifices. All of those things. We are now in a different category than we were before. And because of that, there are certain actions we need to do. One of them being to approach the throne, to make use of that access. We have access to God. We need to make use of that, not just say, oh, it's nice, I have access. But actually use that access to accomplish something. So that's the first thing. The first thing that's brought out. Then you go to verse 23. Again, knowing that Jesus is our high priest, knowing that we have access. Verse 23 says, let's hold fast the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful that promised. So we have to hold fast. One thing, you approach the throne, you engage, God in that conversation, as it were, or he engages us, he invites us. It's a blanket invitation. You don't have to have a particular invitation. Please come today. But now we're to hold fast. Now, that is a word, hold fast is a fine translation. Anybody have something different for hold fast? I saw something interesting about that word. It's a technical term. If you are a sailor, and I'm not a sailor, I don't understand sailing, but if you are a sailor, you have to learn how to go in the right direction. Forget the fact that you got to go back and forth to follow the wind. I'm not going to go into that. That's not the part of this word. But if you want to get from here to there, you've got to get your sail in the right direction, your keel the pointed, and all those kind of things, and you've got to make it work, your rudder and however it works, and you've got to have a good course. That's a word for steering a boat. Hold fast. Keep the true heading that you need to go on. We could use it today for an airplane or a spaceship. You have to have that right, that correct heading. And you got to make sure that, the whole phase, you got to stick to it or you'll get way off. So that's what it means. Without wavering, without going back and forth and getting off track. Why? Because God will follow through. It says he's faithful that he promised. So we need to hold fast. Hang on, as it were. Although that could use that later, too. Hold fast. Steer straight. Stay on course. Now, we already covered it in the previous chapters, but you see there's a backstory here, isn't there? And he'll mention it in particular here in a few verses. But there's a backstory. There's a history with this congregation. And they've gone through some things. So when he says hold fast, it's not just out of the blue he's saying hold fast. There's a history here. There's a reason why they have to hold fast. And there's a reason why he's mentioning that. So we need to draw near, we need to approach the throne, take advantage of that access, need to stay on a straight path without getting off course. And then verse 24, it says, consider one another, in King James, to provoke unto love and to good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together. Verse 25, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the time approaching, or the day approaching. Consider how to stimulate and encourage others, one another, to good. If I were writing this, I don't think I would go from, having access to God to steering a straight path to saying, and consider how to provoke one another to do good things. That wouldn't have occurred to me in that order, but it did to him. And, of course, again, there's the backstory that's part of the reason for this. What is necessary, by definition, what is necessary to be the case if we are to encourage one another to love and good works? What has to be the case?
Get together.
I'm sorry?
You have to get together.
You can't do that if you can't encourage somebody else unless somehow you have contact with them. And that was a concern of this apparently absentee pastor. I mean, he was either pastoring a lot of places or he was traveling, whatever. He had to write this to a congregation where he wasn't there to present the material himself. And he said, spend some time thinking about how you can encourage each other. The implication being that they all needed encouragement and that it was a good use of their time and energy to figure out how to encourage each other. And verse 25 says, not forsaking the assembling of themselves together, as the manner of some is. So they've had some people in the congregation who've been staying home without a good reason. Not that there can be a good reason maybe to stay home, but this was just staying home. They just gave up, weary, whatever the reason. That doesn't say here. But they were staying home. And his point is, you can't encourage one another if you're staying home. You can't be encouraged, and you can't encourage somebody else. So it's important to get together. Obviously, right here, what we're doing now in a worship service is the most obvious application of that. But you have others. You get together. You go bowling, or we have a night where we're going to go out and eat, and all that. Those are opportunities to be with one another, to learn more about each other's lives, and to encourage and uplift each other. And can't do that if we stay home just because we don't feel like doing it. And the author of the book of Hebrews was concerned about that, because this was a congregation that had experienced some stresses in the past and was apparently going to experience some in the future. So he's concerned that people would be, I just don't need to bother. And he's worried about that. He says, you need to be with each other. He's already has said that Jesus is the high priest over the church, right? The body. It's his body. So how can he effectively encourage, manage, do whatever it is he's doing with his body if his body won't be his body? It won't be together. If we're all somewhere, just staying home by ourselves, that doesn't mean God can't work with us. I'm not saying it can't. And sometimes it has to be that way for whatever reason. But in general, the Christian enterprise, according to the New Testament, is the one where we are supposed to involve ourselves in each other's lives and be an encouragement to each other. And that's the way it's intended to be. That's the way we are supposed to learn. And it's apparently what God intended. So there's the recommendation. Now that we understand this, let's approach the throne. Let's make use of that access we have to the Father. Let's hold fast, that is, steer a straight path, not get off course, and provoke one another, that is, encourage, urge, whatever you want to do, light a fire under each other, whatever it is, you know, by encouraging and uplifting one another to hang in there and to be involved in more good works, more good things. And then, after that, we move on to the next paragraph, if you want to call it that, which is verses 26 to 31. And we have some pretty strong language for what could be the case if we don't do those things. And he's already said, all right, if you had serious consequences under Moses, how much more serious could the consequences be in the new covenant? You know, it's not like the new covenant's easy. The new covenant, it has even more demands, and the rewards are greater, but the penalties are greater. The risks are greater. So he goes into that in the next few verses. Verse 26. And this is following right after he's expressed a concern about people just staying away from the body. And again, I'm in the King James. For if we sin willfully after that we have received the knowledge of the truth, there remains no more sacrifice for sins. Who has a different translation for if we sin willfully? Anybody have something different there? At the beginning of verse 26. Deliberately keep on sinning. All right, okay. John, what? That's what you have? Anybody have anything else? So, sinning willfully. Yeah, we don't want to get bent out of shape worrying about what was called the unpardonable sin. And there's some good verses here that help explain that. Sin willfully. Well, most sin is willful, in a sense. You know, if I lose my temper, I've done that on purpose. I don't want to lose my temper, but I'm going to lose my temper anyway. You know, but is that willful sin? Well, that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about deliberately persisting in sin, as Rick's translation there and John's translation say. In other words, choosing a course of action that is opposed to the way of God and then persisting in that over a long period of time. It's not referring to slipping and falling, okay, and that being willful sin. So King James doesn't maybe do it justice in the translation. But if we deliberately persist in sin, so again, not referring to the slips and falls. In the Old Testament, if you had somebody who was a deliberate sinner and, you know, that in a sense thumbed his nose at the establishment and said, I don't want to do this way of life, I'm out of here. The instructions were, don't know how often they were actually carried out, but the instructions were to let them be out of here. You know, they shouldn't be part of the community if they're not going to cooperate. They need to be, cut off from among the people, was the expression. So this is an application of that Old Testament principle, that if you're not going to be part of the group, then don't be part of the group. You know, but it's a conscious decision. And again, he's concerned because people are just kind of drifting away and not going, not being part of anything. And eventually his concern is that you'll turn that ship and go in a different direction. Repentance is when you turn the first time, right? That's what the word repent means. And I think it's Hebrew. You know, you turn. Well, if you turn again, then you're going back in the wrong direction. So he's concerned about that. And then he says something interesting, which I hadn't thought of before. I mean, I've read this, and you have a whole bunch of times. But it says, if you've done that, there remains no more sacrifice for sins. Anybody want to say something about you? What's that mean? I'd read that for years and say, well, it just means that there's an unpardonable sin, and there's some things that Jesus' sacrifice isn't going to work for that one. But I don't think that's what it means. Anybody ever gone through that? I never thought about it more until working on this sermon. It goes back to what he's already said. What's it say here? And is there any other translation anybody has it that adds anything there? It just says, there remains no more sacrifice for sins. If you have persistently, if you've chosen this path and you persistently follow the path of sin on purpose over, you know, a long period of time, that's the path, that's the life choice you've made, knowing better. I mean, a lot of people choose to disobey God, but you went, you know, you've already had the truth revealed to you, you understand, and you decide, nah, it's not for me, I don't want it. He says there remains no more sacrifice for sins. Does anybody have a different, any word different there, remains no more sacrifice for sins? I don't remember what the New American Standard had, but it wasn't quite like that.
Mine says, no sacrifice for sins is left.
Is left. Okay. In the context of Hebrews, and that's what I like about having done these three, I'm going to stop with this one, I think. Having done these three sermons, there's a context for it all. He's already made the point that Jesus, what Jesus went through is very different than what happened in the Old Covenant. In the Old Covenant, there's going to be another sacrifice next year on atonement. And there's going to be another sacrifice tomorrow morning. After the evening sacrifice, we're going to have a morning sacrifice. After the morning sacrifice, we're going to have an evening sacrifice. And after the atonement sacrifice, we're going to have another atonement sacrifice next year. There's always another sacrifice. With Jesus, there isn't another sacrifice. It's done. It's over. There's not going to be another one. That's his point. And I don't think he's making the point of what the sacrifice can apply to or not apply to. Looking at the whole context of the book, I don't think that's what he's saying. He's just saying there isn't going to be another one. You don't have a next year in that sense. He died once and for all. So again, the context I think helps here. Looking at the book, rather than looking at just that verse and thinking, oh, I'm going to do a study on unpardonable sin, and you look at that verse, but you got to look at the whole book and see what the author's driving at. And I think that's what he's driving at. There is no more sacrifice. He's not going to do it again next year or next month or next whatever, like it was in the Old Covenant. That's different. So you won't have another, as Rick's translation says, you won't have another one to pick from. It's not a smorgasbord. I don't like this sacrifice, I'll take this one. No, there's only one. There isn't another one. Now, therefore, because of that, verse 27 says, but a certain fearful looking for of judgment and fiery indignation which shall devour the adversaries, which is a loose quote of Isaiah 26 and verse 11. So if you make that decision and that choice in your life, what you should expect is judgment. And he's going to come back to that in another couple of verses too. That, you know, if you thought it was tough under the Old Covenant, it's tough under the New Covenant too. You know, it's not an out, it's not easy. Verse 28. He that despised Moses' law died without mercy under two or three witnesses. How much sorer punishment, suppose you, shall he be thought worthy who hath trodden underfoot the Son of God and hath counted the blood of the covenant wherewith he was sanctified as an unholy thing and has done despite to the Spirit of grace. So once again, it's that how much more idea. You know, if you think it was bad, if you think there was God took vengeance in the Old Covenant, how much more if you reject Christ and not just rejecting, you know, a high priest or whatever it might have been then? How much more? I mean, we saw that already in Hebrews chapter 2 and verses 2 and 3 where he begins making the comparison with Moses and says, how much more? How much more shall we listen to Jesus? But verse 29 gives you an idea of what type of a person was being described back in verses 26 and 27. You know, the King James just says sin willfully. So you could get into a frame of mind, I'm telling you don't do this, but you could get in a frame of mind, oh, you know, I really didn't resist. I was kind of willful and I did that and, you know, I'm guilty. I'm guilty of the unpardonable sin. No, here's verse 29 starts describing in more detail what type of a person is being talked about. It's he who has trodden underfoot the Son of God and has counted the blood of the covenant wherewith he was sanctified as an unholy thing, and it's done despite the Spirit of grace. So it's a conscious turning your back on what you know to be right and true and good. It's knowing what you're doing. You're not deceived. You're not just caught up in something. It's a conscious, it seems to me describing a conscious decision, knowing what you're deciding, and for the long haul, not, you know, having a bad week or a bad month, or even a bad year for that matter. I'm not put a time limit to it. God desires that all be saved. I don't think he's up there saying, hip. I gave him a year and it's been 354 days. Tomorrow's it. I don't think God's like that. I don't think that's the God we worship. 364, sorry. I don't even know how many days are in a year. Verse 30 says, "For we know him that has said, vengeance belongs to me, and I will recompense, says the Lord. And again, the Lord will judge his people." Quotes there from Deuteronomy. And a fear, it says, it is a fearful thing to fall in the hands of the living God. You know, God will judge. It's not our problem. I don't have to judge. You don't have to judge. God will take care of that. But we ought to, in a right way, fear what God will do to those that fall into that category, if you want to put it that way. So, because we have this understanding, because Jesus is the high priest, and because we have access to the throne, we need to approach the throne. We need to steer a straight course and hang on, and we need to encourage one another, provoke to good love and good works. If we don't, there's warnings of what can happen. But then he changes his tack here a little bit in verse 32. And, you know, because he's just kind of got the sledge, he just had the sledge out saying, here's what can happen, kaboom, you know, can be bad. And I can remember many, many years ago being involved in a church situation in a club, or I think it was a club, and I there was something that needed to be said, and I said it. And I said it kind of, I kind of got the sledge out, and I thought I was being nice about it, but it's kind of like, you know, it was a damper on everything. I didn't know how to lift. I was chairing this meeting. I didn't know how to lift people out of the funk that I'd put them in. And the writer here understands that that's a risk that he takes. And so in verse 32, after he's gotten the sledge out and said, you know, there's something to worry about here and you better watch it, notice what he does. He's got the smarts to do this. "But call to remembrance the former days, in which after you were illuminated," that is, after you understood, "you endured a great fight of afflictions." Okay? So remember, you've been through some tough times before, and you made it through. Okay. So he immediately goes from what could be perceived or taken negatively to a positive thing. It's like, yeah, think about that. You've done this before. You can do this. And you, not only can you do it, but you have already done it before. So he gets back to reassuring them and praising them for some past works. And that's a really nice thing. Remember, you know, focus on the good. There might be some bad out there. There is a bad. There's going to be more bad, but focus on the good. Verse 33, "Partly while you were made a gazing stock," it says. Now, John and Rick, I guess you have something different there for gazing stock. What do you have? Publicly exposed to insult and persecution. Okay. John, you got something like that?
Publicly exposed to reproach and affliction.
Okay. Publicly exposed. That's good. And we don't get that with, maybe with gazing stock. I wasn't around then in 1600s. Does that mean that you're in the stocks? You got your head in one? I don't know. I didn't look it up. I should have. Is that what that means? Anybody know? I mean, you're in the stocks and everybody can look at your head on the one side. So you're publicly humiliated. So if that's the case, then that's the right, that's a good translation. It just doesn't work for us today. But that's the point of that word, though. The point is that many of the people in this congregation were publicly humiliated somehow or another. And that word that's translated there, where we got gazing stock and publicly humiliated and so forth, that's a word that comes from the stage. And it has to do with bringing somebody on stage, which is a positive thing. But eventually, over time, it got the negative connotation that it was to humiliate somebody in public. And the writer here is making the point that you as a congregation have been through this. You have been publicly humiliated and used spitefully. And you know, you made it through. So he's complimenting them for what they'd already endured. They were a public, and he says, it's interesting the way it's phrased. He said, both by reproaches and afflictions, and partly while you became companions of them that were so used. John and Rick, can you help us out on that one? You got to have something different than that at the end of verse 33. Okay, thank you. Does everybody hear that? You know, sometimes you went through it yourself, but some of you didn't go through it yourself, but you were right there standing right with the people who were. You were encouraging them. You were supporting them. You know, maybe all of you didn't go through this. Some of you did. Others of you stood right there and helped the ones who did. And by that, you know, if somebody's being publicly humiliated, you don't usually have a long line of people that are wanting to be by their side, do you? Well, you don't want to share in that humiliation. But he was complimenting this congregation that they had this bond between them that when some of them were being misused and publicly humiliated, others said, hey, I'm with him. I'm with her. So he was complimenting them for that. And, of course, that's a bond that comes from spending time together and going through things together, not from staying home and being apart from one another. So, verse 34 says, for you had compassion of me in my bonds, and took joyfully the spoiling of your goods, knowing in yourselves that you have in heaven a better and enduring substance. So some of them had some of their possessions, maybe their land, houses, I don't know, confiscated, either by the government or by others that had power. And he's complimenting them, that they took care of one another when they were going through that, and that some of them were willing to lose their possessions because of their beliefs. It wasn't just because, you know, there happened to be in a war zone, as happens to so many people, but in this case it was because of what they believed and supporting the writer and his bonds and so forth, and supporting one another. Some of them lost what they had, and they were willing to do that because they knew that this was just the preparation ground. They're looking forward, as he's going to point out in the next chapter, you know, they're looking for a city that was to come, not the city that they were, that was there now. Verse 35, we get to the closing bookend there. Cast not away, therefore, your confidence, which has great recompense of reward. All right, this is that the bookend. You have the confidence, but don't throw it away. It's a gift. It's been given to you. Don't throw it away. Don't just stay home and bail out and opt out of everything, because that's throwing away the gift that you've been given. He says, don't do that. Don't toss it aside. We need that. And then it says, because, again, King James, which has great recompense of reward. That word, there's other words for reward. This word is only used three times in the New Testament. They're all in the book of Hebrews. And it's a word that means, recompense is probably a good way to translate it. It means a wage, what you get. So it doesn't necessarily mean a good reward. Could be a bad reward, right? It means what you get for what you did. used three times. This is just for the sake of completeness. Since they're all here in Hebrews, we can look at all of them. One of them is in Hebrews chapter 2. It's kind of four times, so I'll show you why. But this specific word only used three times. Hebrews 2, verse 2. For the word spoken by angels, if the word spoken by angels was steadfast, and every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense of reward, do you have penalty, Rick or John?
Punishment.
Hmm? Punishment? Yeah. So in that case, the reward is a negative thing, all right? And then in 10 verse 35, it doesn't specify. It just says, but we're talking about something positive because you're going to have a good reward for using that, for taking advantage of that confidence. And then in verse 11, chapter 11 and verse 26, it says that Moses esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. So he's thinking about the, you know, the future, that he was going to get a payment there in a sense. In Hebrews 11:6, it also says that God is the rewarder of the, you know, he's talking about faith. Hebrews 11 verse 6, without faith it's impossible to please him, for he that comes to God must believe that he is, and that he's a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. That's that same word in a different form of that same root word, being a rewarder in this case, the person who gives, the one who gives the reward or the recompense or the wage. So it's only used four times, but that's what it's talking about. It's a wage. It can be positive or negative. And in verse 36, I'm sorry, it's a positive thing. Moving on to the conclusion in the end of chapter 10 here. Verse 37, for yet a little while, and he that shall come will come, and won't tarry. Now, he's quoting from various verses there, and loosely quoting in some cases. Actually, I should read 36 first, I'm sorry. Verse 36, for you have need of patience, and after that, after you have done the will of God, that you might receive the promise. So, an encouragement to endure to the end. You know, do the will of God. It's not just, I won't say it's not just enduring, but to the writer of Hebrews, enduring meant being obedient over the long haul. Not just enduring wrong or enduring, you know, bad things, but being in a state of, in an attitude of obedience over the long term, no matter what happens. That's, obedience and endurance are coupled here by the writer of the book of Hebrews. And then in verse 37, saying, you know, Jesus' return is still future, but we need to endure. And he's quoting from Habakkuk and a little bit from Isaiah, a little bit of a loose quoting there. Because it says, for yet a little while. Like, where does that come from? That's not in Habakkuk. But it's in Isaiah, and it's Isaiah 26, verse 20, I think. And I am going to turn. That's the one place I'm going to turn. Because there's a... I know we've talked about it before. I think Mike has mentioned it years ago, and I might have mentioned it too. Isaiah 26. There's a term in Hebrew called remetz, I think is how you say it. And it's a way of dropping a hint at a whole thought without saying the whole thought. And again, if you grew up in a culture where you, especially as a male, you learned the scripture from the time you're a little kid. You had them memorized. You had the important ones memorized. You had a lot of the bulk of the books memorized, or at least their structure and so forth. If someone quoted just one little part of a verse, you knew what the rest of the verse was. And so writers in the New Testament sometimes would drop a word, a term, or in this case, just a little bit of this verse, knowing that the reader is going to recognize that term and their brain is going to go back to that verse, the whole verse, even though they haven't quoted the whole verse. And the word for that technique is remetz, if I'm saying that correctly. So in Isaiah 26 and verse 20, and again, it's King James. Come, my people, enter you into your chambers, and shut the door about you. Hide yourself, as it were, for a little moment until the indignation be overpassed. Now, I'm not going into the context here, and the writer here is taking it out of the context anyway. All he took out of that was just a little while quote. But if you notice, that whole quote has to do with holding yourself up in your house, which he's telling you not to do. So is he doing that on purpose to get you thinking about this? That there's a time maybe to hold yourself up in your house and, you know, and stay away, but there's a time not to? I don't know. I'm not in the guy's brain, but it's interesting that he quotes this little tiny bit from Isaiah 26:20 without quoting the whole thing. He goes, because he quotes the rest of it from Habakkuk chapter 2. But if you look at the rest of that verse in Isaiah, it has to do with staying away or staying locked up. So maybe that's a case of that, where he just wants that to come to their mind and think that this isn't the time to do that. You might be using that as an excuse. Maybe some of them even were using that verse as a reason. You know, I don't know. I don't know what was going on, but for some reason he decided to quote a little bit from that verse. Verse 38. Now the just shall live by faith. Again, that's coming from Habakkuk. But if any man draw back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him. And that's an interesting use of scripture too. And in Second Temple times, as you notice from reading the New Testament, they took a lot of freedom in how they interpreted the Old Testament. They just take things out of context. When you take a verse here, take a verse there, throw them together. It's kind of like if you know what the result should be, it was allowable to grab different verses and use them and put them together in certain ways. That was typical of Second Temple Bible exegesis, if you want to put it that way. So it's not uncommon for a writer of one of the books of the Bible to do that. You see Paul doing it all the time. And here, he's quoting messianic verses. And, you know, the Messiah is supposed to come and accomplish everything that he sets out to do. As it turned out, we know it didn't. It's split up. You know, some happens first coming, some happens second coming. But the point of Habakkuk, the point of the quote there in the Old Covenant is to say, if somebody comes claiming to be Messiah and they don't follow through and just go, you know, and do what they're supposed to do, they're not real. They're fake. But the writer here is using it in a different way. He's saying, if you hold back from doing what you're supposed to do, God has no pleasure in you. So he's taking something that was used a certain way in the Old Testament, taking that verse and using it in a different way in the New Testament. That's not uncommon. They did it a lot. But he's making the point that we need to not hold back. We have that access to God, right? We have the opportunity to steer straight. We have those things going for us because of what Jesus did. Now's not the time to hold back. We have all these things going for us. We need to make use of it. So verse 39 says, we are not of them who draw back into perdition, but of them who believe to the saving of the soul. All right, so we're not the ones that hold back. We're not the ones who want to be leaving our calling, leaving our way of life, and going back to the way of the world. We don't want to do that. So there's his conclusion. And also, in 38, you know, the just shall live by faith. He's introducing, he's also working his way into chapter 11, where he's going to talk about faith and faith by works. You know, it's a list of the faithful, but it's all the things they did. A lot of verbs in Hebrews 11. So he makes that point. We won't get into that. So the writer here, he's made the point that Jesus is our high priest, that he's opened up the veil. And now we can boldly approach to the throne and talk openly because it's our right as a citizen of heaven, you might say. Just like it was a right of a citizen in Greece to talk at the forum. Because of that, let's draw near. Let's approach the throne. Take advantage of that access. We can go boldly, with confidence, with authorization. Let's hold fast. Let's steer that straight course. Not get off course. And provoke each other to love and to good works. And we have to do that often by being with each other. That's how that happens. And because if we don't, judgment belongs to God. And we can rightfully and in the right way fear that judgment. And then he says, so remember how you've had opportunity to do so much good in the past when things weren't going well. And remember that, and using that as maybe an impetus, endure into the future. Don't hold back. Jesus is returning, and his reward is with him. He says, hang in there, hang in there.